Hello and welcome to Minter Dialogue, episode number 304. Today is Sunday, the 25th of November, 2018. And just before introducing my guest for this week, I wanted to do a shout out to Autumn Schultz for your wonderful recent review in iTunes. This week's guest is Kalle Palling, who has been an MP of the Estonian Parliament starting in 2007 when he was just 22 years old. He's very active in pushing through legislation around technology and e-governance, helping Estonia to accelerate its transformation to a digital state and becoming a lightning rod for change. Among his further credentials, aside from having been on a number of high-profile supervisory boards, Kalle is also an entrepreneur, co-founding Cachet, an insurance marketplace and personal data hub. In this conversation with Kalle, we discuss the journey that Estonia has undergone to become a beacon of digital states, the challenges of transformation, some of Kalle's thoughts on new tech and prospects for the future. A most insightful interview. Welcome to the Minter Dialogue podcast, where we discuss branding and all things digital. I am Minter Dial, your host, and you'll find the show notes on my eponymous site, MinterDial.com. Enjoy the show. Kalle Palling. Great to have this opportunity to chat with you in the halls of the Estonian Parliament. So, Kalle, in your own words, tell us who you are and what you do.
it's great to have that talk, but I'm a 33-year-old Estonian tech visionary and politician who has worked in the Parliament for 12 years as a member of Parliament.
You and I have met a couple of times, several times now, even in London. And you told me about how you got involved in politics. And really, as I understand it, you have to be amongst the youngest ministers in government anywhere in Europe, if not the youngest. And you're in charge, back 12 years ago, of this whole idea of digitizing Estonia. So talk us through what happened, the history of that idea, and how it came to be that you were the one that participated, if not led, this whole charge.
I can't take the responsibility of leading this change because when I was elected to the parliament, then the process was already started quite long ago. So basically, when we regained our independence in the early 90s, then we understood that we don't ever want to be alone again. And we understood that we are relatively poor to achieve the things that our neighbors, for example, like Finland, have achieved already. So we had to do many things much faster than the others. And to do that, we already understood that the technology will play a huge role in the future. And to every reform we did, we included this digital mindset. And today we estimate that one-third of the GDP growth has come from this, let's say, additional digitizing part to the structural reforms. And currently we even estimate that we save 2% of GDP annually by doing things digitally. So it's quite a good combination in added value or efficiency for the state.
So when you all started, of course, it wasn't you as a 21-year-old who was leading the whole thing, but you obviously contributed heavily and you brought in a very fresh mindset, yet you also had a leader that was obviously wanting to take on this whole gambit, and it was in the face of a population that not necessarily welcoming to it. What was his inspiration, and maybe where was he looking for guidance as to how to make this happen in a country? Because really, you guys were pioneering, so one has to imagine that you just can't learn out of nothing. Where were the inspirations coming from?
The inspiration came from abroad, mostly because at that time, the president of Estonia, Toomas Ilves, actually he studied in States during the Soviet time, worked as a diplomat in States early 90s, and he was already involved to this, let's say, building up the state again with a mindset. And again, the government itself was relatively young in early 90s as well. And, and, And one thing which is probably true, we don't know it because everything happens so fast, but one of the cornerstones behind the success of building up an e-state is that the governments and government officials, they trusted private sector. They trusted the entrepreneurs who said that we believe that the world is going to go to that direction and we should do this and that kind of stuff. And then we didn't need to build up our own, let's say, silos like we see in most of the countries nowadays, that, let's say, we have quite efficient, well-functioning private sector, and at the same time we have, let's say, parallel structures in public sector, which we don't need, actually. We just need the collaboration. I mean, business do their business, and for the government it's their duty is to enable it and to regulate it and do all that kind of stuff. So probably the fact that we were so poor in early 90s worked good for us because we didn't have money to build up a huge structure in a public sector. We just had to trust the private sector, and luckily it ended up in a good place.
Well, at some level, it's one of the rules of agility and the new way of operating is think limited resources, think as though you're spending your own money, and presumably because Estonia is such a small country, all the same, resources are limited, and that poverty where necessity breeds is the mother of invention, and the fact that you didn't have all the resources meant you had to be a little bit wilier about it. What would interest me, Carlo, is to look at what were the things that made the transformation happen. When you go back in time and you're thinking about the challenges, because clearly it wasn't an obvious and easy path, what were the big milestones that you managed with your team, with your party, to overcome as you went on this path to get e-Estonia, the e-state, up and running?
Again, one thing that just happened since the early 90s and in the beginning of 2000s, where all the, let's say, real services came into place. I mean, the e-tax and customs board and all these things, ID card and X-Road later on. So it was somehow a political consensus that we were able to achieve. I think in most of the other topics there was no consensus, but building up a society in a way that we include technology and enable technology to operate and to make our, let's say, citizens and businesses' life more hassle-free, it was a consensus. And luckily it's still so that none of the parties are arguing that we shouldn't do it. But what we currently witnessed during the last years is that there needs to be an effort and attention on the highest political level possible to make things happen. Because when we started, there wasn't that kind of competition in the world between the states. So who will be faster and who will enable some sort of technology to operate, which means that this company will probably pay taxes for the country as well. But currently it's a competition. And it's not only a competition between countries, it's a competition between continents. So if we take states, Asia, mainly China, and then European Union, then I think that European Union is lacking far behind of the others, and probably in a few years we'll see China taking the first place in being the digital tiger or digital leader or whatever we call them. But the bottom line is that with technology itself, with money only, you won't do anything. You'll need to have this, let's say, leadership. We should go to the moon, and we have to do it, and we have to agree on that, and this is something we do. And then, let's say, the technology and resources will follow. But without the leadership, you can have, I mean, three times more money, but you don't achieve anything.
When you guys defined with your party this vision, because you guys were in power for quite a considerable amount of time, how would you describe that unifying force that allowed that vision to galvanize all members bipartisanly, or at least other parties, to follow you? Because these decisions did mean that other resources weren't being attributed, other things were not happening, that you were having to allocate specific to this project, even though it benefits down the road. But what was the guiding principle that allowed for everyone to say, all right, we agree, we're going to go in with you?
There was a certain proof after every, let's say, reform and launching new services that this is the thing that it's working. Will it be, let's say, decrease of number of public officials? Will it be some saving in the budget? So there was always, I mean, the service itself was more comfortable. Citizens as the clients for the state was more satisfied with the service, and so there was always some proof, and it's getting more and more challenging each year to answer the expectations, actually, that really the services will run seamlessly maybe next year or in the next couple of years. So back then, what I want to say is that it was so much easier to agree on that and to find the consensus and to find the followers for your let's say leadership in this world of technology. But now the things are much more complex, and it's and there are also threats. When we started with e-voting, for example, in 2005, so I mean, if we would have had a scandal like there was in States with Cambridge Analytica, I think this would have been something something really hard to explain. Although the voting system in States and the voting system is in Estonia, they are, let's say, totally different things. So we have this, let's say, many security measures that the systems in other countries don't have. That's why it's so unique. But if I have something to suggest to other countries, then definitely e-voting is not the service from where to start, because currently there are so many emotions around all the elections, not only e-elections, which somebody is trying to let's say hack or to do something.
So where I get interested in this, and where most of the listeners will be, they're not usually running countries or ministers of departments, yet they're trying to figure out how to accelerate, improve, increase resources in their transformation process. And so there you are back 12 years ago, and you're participating in this, and you're showing promises delivered against cost savings or whatever you're doing. But how on earth did you measure these things? It's not like you could say, well, in these other 16 countries, when they did it, they gained 2%. So you have to come up with a number that you need to achieve, and it has to presumably be provable. So I'm just wondering what that process was. That did you go for low-hanging fruit? What were the things that you were doing? Because you obviously can't promise everything right away, even though what's interesting about the e-state is that it's kind of all-encompassing. I mean, it doesn't do everything, but it really does encompass a lot of things.
Yeah, I mean, it's somehow hard to explain, but probably, I mean, the awareness of achieving the level of using technology in the society was so high. The expectations were so high already in the mid 90s when we started. I mean, internetizing all the country where we already have this public internet access points for all the citizens. But we started teaching, I mean, computer science already from the fourth grade in the schools, and then the, let's say, with doing that, the expectations did grow all the time. But But at the same time, one thing that I haven't mentioned before is that, I mean, like we have that today in most of the countries, so the competition between private and public sector for skilled labor, it has been an issue for years in Estonia. And actually to get good people for work or to work for the public sector, it's anyway a challenge. So we need to automize the services that could be automized. We need to replace the stupid jobs that could be replaced with technology to decrease the bureaucracy, and it's currently even more important than it was back then because currently we can't say anymore that we'll have to decrease the number of public officials working, let's say, for the government institutions because there will be a so huge transformation in the field of work, in the field of education, the work itself that the officials and public sector workers have to do is different, but the amount could be even bigger than it has been so far because there are so many things changing, and none of the states and none of the leaders of the states would like to see somebody left behind, I mean the citizens. So this is a challenge which we are facing, and I believe that even we don't have a good answer for that. In terms of the timing as well, because I mean there is always a need to find the right timing. When will be the break even to change the people for the machine to do the job and in a way that the person itself don't get hurt, I mean emotionally and mentally, because they need to be ready to relearn. Nobody wants to get rid of the people, but they need to be ready to relearn, and this is a challenge as well, because not all the people are ready to relearn like this.
For sure. Well, what you say actually resonates, because in the end of the day, so many companies are looking at all these technologies, and it is complex, and it's somewhat all interrelated, and it's very hard to sort of craft your way through it, because A, a lot of us are already behind the eight ball in the first place, and now there's a new wave and it's more complex, and the whole evolution is you're obviously getting, you know, quite expertised in artificial intelligence. What role will it have, an impact on society? And then on top of that, in politics, you have to deal with the narrative, elections, and timing becomes critically important in that context.
It is, but and it is especially important at the time now when we see so much, trying to do a bit of everything kind of attitude in the society, try to be liked by everybody in the society, also in the field of, let's say, politics. And this is worrying me a bit because in that sense we don't have, let's say, I'm not saying that we don't have anybody, but we have relatively smaller amount of people trying to follow us at all. And not only, let's say, specifically, for example, our party, but also all the politicians, because they don't, let's say, resonate with each other anymore. And I mean, maybe it's a wrong example, but I believe that. And when I was younger in high school, and I always, let's say, admired politicians, and they were like father figures or something that they who always seemed to be clever than we were, and then they knew the direction where to go, and then had this, let's say, we have to go to the moon attitude. But currently what we see is the huge amount of political correctness and not trying to say anything in politics, and keeping in mind all the challenges which we talked already before. I mean, artificial intelligence, enabling and regulating technology and platforms, and all that kind of stuff. So it's worrying me, because there you'll need to make unpopular decisions, and the huge amount of unpopular decisions, because the speed of the development of technology is so fast. It has been said even this way, that during the next 5 years, the technology will develop as much as it has developed during the last 100 years. So basically, if we take the last 100 years evolutionary, then the next, let's say, 5 years, it's measured or equal as 100 years. So we don't have time at all. So there will be a new, I wouldn't say world order, but basically the huge restructuring in the economy, and as the digital, let's say, tiger will come relocate the economic centers.
Well, there's a lot to be said about politics for sure, and especially in certain countries, how the political parties don't actually line up with what people want, and you know, every party has certain issues, but you don't want all of them. I'm half this, half that, and a lot of people don't seem to attach themselves to parties. I want to get into with regard specifically to Eastate, because, and you can correct me where I'm wrong, but we now have a country that is entirely equipped. Everybody has a card, an identity card, that not only is an identity card, but is also my medical records, is able to do my tax returns at the end of the year in a matter of minutes, thanks to tracking me throughout my year. If I'm in certain countries, my eyebrows are raised as I'm listening to this, thinking, oh my God, the state knows everything about me. So, A, do you believe that's what the situation is in Estonia? And how on earth did you get that passed through?
Because of citizens trusting the state, because they witness that if they allow and they open some of the data points of themselves for the state, the life itself will be so much, let's say, easier and more comfortable. I mean, if you have your pre-filled tax declaration in the beginning of February, and then submitting it takes maybe 3 minutes if you're slow, then I mean, being a citizen of Greece, for example, where you probably have to take a week off to declare your taxes,
to hide your swimming pool.
So I mean, 3 minutes and a week, it's basically you have a additional week for vacation. I mean, annually, and it's a big thing. It's a big thing. So the two most let's say the two things that people are usually lacking of is time and money. So basically, what we are doing in Estonia is we are saving people's time and money, because I mean, building up this efficient system, it saves quite a lot of money. So for a business, it's more time to focus on your business case, to develop your business, to communicate with the clients, and do all these things. And for the families, it's time to play with your children or do the family stuff. So instead of, I mean, filling out some bureaucratic documents.
Kalle, you have traveled, and the idea of trusting a government is something that's not given in many countries. If you know, to find another country where people unilaterally say that they have trust in the government, how does that trust get created? And maybe if you're thinking in you're another country, how does one create that trust? And what are the lessons learned and things that you would advise if you're an organization, whether governmental or business, and you want to have trust, be trusted?
Technically speaking, it's a question of having no backdoors. So basically, citizens can trust the government, let's say, agencies and services if they know that the information that they donate or they allow the access is kept safely and it can't be changed. And for that, already in 2010, we started using some pieces of the early blockchain technology. We called it KSI timestamp back then. But it was used because to have the opportunity to prove mathematically that that all the information that is here in your data container is kept safely and that none of it is manipulated in some case. And the other principle is that that you're the owner of your data. I mean, we have all the case summaries in e-healthcare system, and I can whether open it or close it for doctors. So, but if we think philosophically, so, I mean, if I get to an accident and I have some certain very specific allergies, some medicines work for me, some doesn't, and if I have opportunity to close the information, but then I know that that I could die because the doctors don't know which medicines work for me and then which don't, or I open it and it could save my life. And if there is a micro percent of chance that some doctor who has the access for the information will let's say misuse the information, then I would always choose let's say saving my life. And there is always a good example with most of the hospitals worldwide where information is kept on paper. So basically, if I take
with poorly written doctor's handwriting.
Yeah, and this is another which, and the handwriting is usually something that nobody understands. Yeah. But at least in Estonia, but basically, it's. I mean, if somebody forgets it on a table, so it's very easy to go and make a photo of it and send to a newspaper, and basically nobody will get where this information came from. But if it's an electronic system, then from every log there will be a sign, and basically we have even designed the regulations and legislations in a way that I can claim the person who saw the information about me but didn't have the reason to see the information about me. And it's the same way in a police system. I mean, they all have access to check about me, I mean, even every minute. But if they misuse the information, then it's getting criminal.
Whether it's the people that are surrounding us in Parliament or the people, there must have been an enormous effort on education. And when you say no back door, I'm wondering, was this a yes or no Boolean, you have to do it, as in the entire population needs one day, everybody has to have the e-card? So talk us through the educational elements and maybe the challenges you had in educating, whether it was your peers in government or in parliament or the people.
So it was correctly pointed that basically with one day everybody needs to have this ID card. Of course, it wasn't one day, but it was a principle since the beginning that it will be mandatory. Actually, we wasn't the only ones who developed and found out that electronic identity will be the future. Actually, Finns did it, but they did it in a way that they continued to issue the cards and identity voluntarily. So basically, I mean, if you have to keep up two parallel systems, I mean, the paper-based state, very briefly saying, and then the electronic state, then it won't work out. So we did it in a way that during 3 years, everybody had to change their documents, and then we issued this ID card, which is the physical part of electronic identity. It's much more than ID card. It just allows you access to the system. And back then we didn't have much services, so probably we are joking that the only thing that we did with it was that we cleaned the car windows from ice.
Yeah.
During the winter. But then actually the private sector was the key in making these e-services, to boom. We call them killer applications, and these, the first killer applications was internet banking and e-school, both done by private sector. And then banks said that if you want to make transactions bigger than 300 euros per day, then you must use electronic identity to identify yourself. Before that, we had these code cards and PIN calculators and that kind of stuff, which are used in many other countries since today. But this was the first one, and the other one was eSchool, which is basically the system where there was no paper diary, where teachers give grades for the students. They uploaded it to the e-school system, and also the homework part, and also the feedback how the student acted in a school. It's really, really comfortable. Currently, I'm as a new, let's say, my son went to first grade this year, and it's really, really comfortable to get the feedback from there. But to log into the system, you need to identify yourself with electronic identity. And you can imagine how many parents we have for the students. So that it was another killer application where we saw the number of electronic ID users going up, and it's really, really good. And then it's easier afterwards to add, electronic prescriptions, e-healthcare system, all the other kind of things that you can, where you can identify and verify yourself with electronic identity. And then currently, in all the sector, especially financial sector, the biggest issue is verification. How do you log into your financial service? How do you make sure that this is you? And here we have even another results by being developed by Estonian startups, which don't take either fingerprint or card only, because it's quite easy to Photoshop the card and to get it from the black market, and much. Much more important is the face biometrics. So in some of the cases in the future, probably we are logging in using our face.
Are there any, as I understand it, you can't use the card to pay. You can use it to identify your identity. We can also use it for your commercial loyalty schemes here. And I know that we still have cash. But you are very much moving towards a cash lesser state. What does the future hold? What are the next big steps for Estonia in your mind?
The next big steps probably are in some other fields, in digital definitely, but next to this, let's say, internal approach, making the state more efficient and develop more and more comfortable services, as the private sector does. Banks and telcos, they are operating seamlessly usually. You don't know how much you pay for your SMS and data megabytes or gigabytes. So the state should operate in the same way, actually, seamlessly. So make the life very comfortable for your client as citizen. So I'll always say it's somehow unpopular to say that the citizens are the clients for the state. And to keep the clients, you have to run the good service, and that's what Estonia is trying to do. And I think that we've done it quite well. And 2014, we understood that this approach that we've had is a totally right thing to do. And then we decided to start with our own governmental startup called e-Residency. And now we issue the electronic identities not physical residences, not citizenship, but electronic identities, which have access to the Estonian internal infrastructure for all the citizens around the world. And currently we have them almost 50,000 from more than 140 different countries who have applied for the residency and for whom we have issued the e-residency. And this is the next big thing in terms of the, let's say, individuals. And probably for the states in the future, Estonia will act as a platform to provide some services. We could run and operate as a tax and customs port for some country, for example, because we have the experience, we know how to make things done. And we just collect the taxes. I mean, in UK, for example, or in some other country, by agreeing that it will be delegated to Estonia, as it's delegated in some of the cases for some private companies, and we can just, let's say, operate the service, take the, let's say, some certain amount of service fee from that, and from that operational stuff, we could guarantee the welfare for our own citizens. So the biggest challenge, what I'm always repeating in all the audiences where I speak, is that the biggest challenge for the states nowadays, is especially European states, is that how to make other countries' citizens to pay for the welfare of your own citizens. So that's where the, let's say, state as a platform concept has came in. And then it's also for the private companies, I mean, to really find out the functioning, let's say, model to operate a global business from Estonia.
I have to imagine that amongst the 140 countries you said that are doing, where applicants are applying for e-residency in Estonia, the Brexit must be provoking or maybe promoting the idea to English companies and people who want to keep a foot in Europe. Is that something that's on the radar? And what can you tell us about that?
It's actually very much connected with that. So basically, if we had some positive news about Estonia and about e-residency in Guardian, for example, and at the same time there was some news about the unclear future, mm-hmm. In terms of the access for the single market and then the relations between UK and European Union in the future, then we see the increase, and usually it's a huge increase of applications from UK after positive from Estonia, negative and combined with negative news from UK, and it's hundreds during 1 week, so it's quite a lot. And from every 1,000 e-resident, we estimate that they will give back 10 million to our economy. So basically every 1,000, 10 million, and it's already quite much, and it's just the start. So if the businesses will grow and develop and so on, so the contribution will be much bigger.
Roughly, how much does an e-residency application cost per year?
It's a cost base. The application itself and the issuing the card, it's around 100 euros because, I mean, all the processing and background search and all that kind of stuff. But for all the other things, I mean, you don't have to pay for the e-residency itself, but you'll pay if you use services. Some services, I mean, accountant, lawyer, somebody, I mean, to help to keep the company up and running.
And this is where you get your 10 million from. Last question for you. UBI, do you believe in the universal basic income? What's your opinion? Because, you know, you're so much involved with the AI folks, and and what's going on in Singularity in California. I was wondering what your opinion is. Is it something that you see has a role in Europe or in Estonia?
I don't see a role for universal basic income, because the concept of universal basic income is that it should be equal to everybody, and we don't need to equalize the societies, because anyway we have these people who need more help and these people who need less help, and that's why it won't work. But I have an idea for the reason behind the universal basic income, and I think that this is something that let's say social democratic parties in all the countries are promoting, because the world has changed so much after the Industrial Revolution that they don't know how and who to protect. Because, the core idea of social democrats is always to protect somebody. And currently, people, they don't need protection in that sense. They need more, let's say, help in finding the right path. And this is what the leaders in the societies have to enable, and this is more liberal approach, I would say, to keep to give a lot of opportunities and to guide and try to let's say find the tailor-made solutions for each one of us, because currently as development is so fast, there is no let's say similar jobs. There will be all let's say tailor-made approaches, much more individual approaches than so far. It's more liberal stuff. And why I can easily say that I don't believe in universal basic income is that with the with all the transformation, we see the increase of the number of jobs. The jobs will be different. A lot of jobs will be gone, but most of them will be replaced. But we need more and more people to do this stuff, because there is so many things to do, and one thing which we need in the society is the universal understanding of humanity and empathy. And this is something that we should put effort on, that we understand what does it mean to be a human being, because at the time when we talk about AI and all this technology stuff and this kind of things, I think none of the solutions applications will replace a human factor, this empathy and ethical factor and all that. That kind of things in the societies, and this is something that we really need nowadays.
Most heartwarming from the ex-minister of digital. So, Kari, thank you for that. It seems like we could have another podcast, or certainly another beer, and talk more about that. As you know, a topic near to my heart. Anyone wants to get in touch with you or follow what you're up to? Is there a good way to catch up with your thoughts, whether it has to be digital, I'm afraid? What is the way?
It's just a Twitter account. It's Color by Link, so in Twitter, so you can follow.
That's great. And we'll find you in different places. You're a frequent speaker at many conferences. And so if someone wants to hire you, come bring you in as a speaker and talk about this, because I think it's an awfully fascinating topic, certainly for democracy, certainly for states, but also the lessons that can be learned and extracted, ironically and most rarely, from government into business. And I think that's what's exciting about the journey that we've been on with you. Kari, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks. Thanks, Minto.
Thanks for having listened to this recording of the Minto Dialogue Show. You'll find the show notes and other blog posts on MintoDial.com. If you enjoyed the show, please like the handy Facebook button, or better yet, head over to iTunes to give a rating and review. But first, relax to Joss Sax's Finger Paint.
Oh, fill me with all your colors any different way to rid me of the gray and heal me.
Questions, we've got answers. Business leadership, ownership, and sales can be challenging. Tune into the Accelerate Your Business Growth podcast to learn from the world's experts. Join me, your host, Diane Helbig, as I chat with people who have expertise in various areas of business. You'll enjoy the lively conversations that are focused on providing you with the ideas, tips, and suggestions you need to realize greater success. Get what you need for your business when you need it from the people who have the answers. Accelerate Your Business Growth is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network and is available on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.